Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. 117 days, 12 hours, 21 minutes, 52 seconds until George Bush leaves office voluntarily. So, what would happen to casino activity if you knew that the odds of winning didn't involve a take for the house? What if you knew that it was 50-50? Don't you think a whole lot more people would gamble if it wasn't guaranteed that over a long period of time you will eventually lose? There'd just be a whole lot. You'd have a whole lot more. Let me start this over here, because this is a really important. I have gone through a series of evolutions of thinking on this financial bailout, this whole economic crisis. You know, what originally it was like, okay, is this the big plan to destroy capitalism in America and to flip us into a fascist state? That was my first response. And then it was, okay, this must be the October surprise. You know, like they're trying to do this, but it seems to be hurting McCain in the polls, although we'll see, because McCain is opposing, or at least not supporting this thing. The Republicans are opposing it. And I think Bernie Sanders was right yesterday. If the Democrats marry themselves to George W. Bush in this thing, they're going to be married to George W. Bush on Election Day. It's going to be a disaster. But, you know, bottom line is, we have, through a series of deregulatory measures, but not just the deregulatory measures, also through a reduction in, or an elimination, actually, in 1966, of the tax, the transaction tax on buying and selling stock, we have created what Congressman Peter DeFazio refers to as a doomsday machine, a neutron bomb, something that was guaranteed to blow up in our faces. And increasingly, it seems apparent to me that these guys plan for this thing to blow up after the election. And it may be that the thing that sped it up was that last year in 2007, there was a very, 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 very small tax on the transactions required on financial transactions. These are referred to as Section 31 fees. These were put into place in 1933 by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And this is 1/300th of 1% on the cost of a stock trade. And this was put into place to fund the SEC, to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And in fact, for the first few years that it existed, for the first 30 years or so, it paid for the SEC. And then as stock speculation really started going whole hog, the revenue from this thing increased to actually it was after 1966, and I'll get to that in just a second. The revenue on this thing started increasing to the point where it was generating several billion dollars a year, and the cost of the SEC was only a couple hundred million. And so in 1999, legislation was put forward to eliminate the fee and just have the SEC paid for out of the general budget. And that happened last year. So what happened was the markets got even more liquid. It was even easier to buy and sell because there was like no risk, no cost at all to buying and selling at the huge level, at the Uber level. I mean, there wasn't even this Section 31 fee. Before that, in order to fund the Civil War, you know, in order to fund the Spanish-American War, actually, first, then the Civil War, then World War One, and we kept this until 1966. It went through World War II. It was doubled during World War II, and it stayed there until 1966. We had a 0.25% tax, quarter of a percent, quarter of 1% on a stock trade. So, you know, 1%, so if you buy $100 worth of stock, 1% would be a dollar, quarter of a percent would be 25 cents. So on a stock trade of $100, you pay 25 cents. And, you know, for the average Joe, I mean, you know, for the average person with a, who's maybe one or two or three times a year moving stocks around in a 401k or a retirement fund, and this might have added up to something that actually wasn't even a fragment of brokerage fees. Maybe a few dozen dollars a year, a few hundred dollars a year at the very most. But for the really big players, the people who are moving around billions of dollars, that was a lot of money. And so when that went away in 1966, the markets started to speed up. We saw this beginning of an exponential increase. So why not just bring this back? A 0.25% tax. We know it works. We've done it in the United States three times. And by the way, we're not the only country that has ever done it. The transaction fee in the United Kingdom right now, where one of the largest and most active stock exchanges in the world is located, the London Stock Exchange, is 0.25%. Why not simply bring this back? A 0.25% fee on trades right now, particularly if it was applied to, you know, right across the board to a whole variety of different types of trades, would generate somewhere in the neighborhood of somewhere between $125 and $200 billion a year. Now, the economist Dean Baker first proposed this back like a year ago. I mean, this is not a new idea. Here I've got March 15, 2008, Dean Baker, a stock transfer tax, the right medicine for Wall Street. Dean Baker, by the way, wrote The Conservative Nanny State. It was one of my BuzzFlash books of the month. If you go over to BuzzFlash, and I don't know if Mark's got the archives on his homepage or not, but you may have to Google it or dig down in there. But there's, you know, a couple of pages there on BuzzFlash that list all of the last 4 years, I think it is, of my books of the month. And The Conservative Nanny State is one of them by Dean Baker. It's great. His subtitle is How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. And he says, you know, this was in March. He says the UK imposes a modest stock transfer tax of 0.25% on every purchase of a sale of stock. It makes almost no difference to a typical middle-class shareholder. Such a tax could raise a great deal of money, about 1% of GDP in the US, $150 billion a year. Now, keep in mind, this bailout that they're talking about is about 4%, almost 5% of GDP. Now, back when Dean Baker proposed it, he said we could use this money to finance a national health care program. And we could have. But now I guess we've got to bail out the banks. So let's let the banks bail themselves out. This is not rocket science. The other benefit of this, of putting a quarter of a percent tax on every single stock transaction, not only does Wall Street get to bail themselves out, but at a certain point, there's going to be a little less activity going on in the market because there's a certain cost to it. Now, Paulson yesterday, when this was presented to him during the hearings, this idea of what about a transfer tax? Let's go back to doing this. He said, oh, no, that would discourage people from trading. Well, yeah, that's the whole point. At a certain point, you want to slow this down. You want to slow things down. Back in June of this year, Joseph Thorndike, a contributing editor with Tax Analysts, wrote this piece for the Tax History Project. It's over at taxanalysts.com called Speculation and Taxation, Time for a Transaction Tax. And he asked the question, how exactly should lawmakers curb speculation? He points out, you know, last week the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and keep in mind this is back in June, invited a few oil market experts to do a little speculating on their own, asking them to assess Wall Street's role in driving oil prices up. They happily obliged, suggesting that a crackdown on some types of investment activity might bring prices down by 50%. So what do lawmakers do to do that? And he suggests a transfer tax. It'll slow down the insane speculation that is driving commodity prices, all kinds of things, in all kinds of different directions. This only vanished in 1966. You see, the first transfer tax was, it can be traced to the early days of the Republic during the Civil War, the Spanish-American War. In 1914, it began again, stayed on the books until 1966. Originally, it was 2 cents per $100 of par value. Then in 1928, congressional leaders tried to reduce it, but progressive leaders, including Republicans like Smoot, said, no, don't do away with the tax. It would encourage speculation. I think this is such a simple solution.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Face it, Americans, we don't think as much about drilling as we should. Whether drilling wood or masonry, drilling for energy, or just a little nice pleasurable drilling at the end of a hard day, drilling should be given its due.
Newt Gingrich, by the way, declared victory, gloating that the Democrats caved and allowed the offshore drilling ban to expire. Anyway, I want to get back to this for a minute. This, I think, is a big deal. John Maynard Keynes laid this out in his book, General Theory of Economics, in 1936. These are called security transaction, what's the word? Excise taxes. STETs, security transaction excise taxes. Countries that have them include Japan, the UK, Germany, Italy, France, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Greece, Ireland, Malaysia. Now, some of these countries are in the process of eliminating them because they're following our lead. We used to have them also. And John Maynard Keynes, in Chapter 12 of General Theory of Economics, back in 1936, said that these taxes were a good thing, a security transaction tax. It's a good thing for the U.S. economy because they should be applied, quote, I'm quoting from Keynes, with a view to mitigating the predominance of speculation over enterprise. In other words, allow people to invest because they think that the value of the company is going to go up. In other words, the company is going to make more goods and services, so the company is worth more, which means our economy is stronger because the company got stronger. Rather than having a whole bunch of people buy a stock hoping to drive up the price of it, regardless of what the company is doing, because it's cheap and easy to buy and sell stocks. That's speculation as opposed to investing. Investing is planning on the increase in value. Speculation is betting or manipulating a market. Keep in mind that the proposal that Paulson has put forward, the Republican proposal, and it needs to be called the Republican proposal, even though the Republicans are all running away from it right now, because it's coming out of this Republican administration. And I'm telling you, the Republicans are walking away from this thing. McCain is going to walk away from it. It's the Bush proposal, really, which is why, strategically, every Democrat who goes on TV or radio should be referring to this as the Republican bailout of the banks and the billionaires. This proposal would cause us to borrow $700 billion from China and Saudi Arabia, because we don't have it to loan to ourselves. and give that money to banks, including not even U.S. banks, and billionaires. What's the effect of that going to be? It's going to debase the dollar. It's going to inflate the currency. It's going to cause the cost of everything that an American buys using U.S. dollars to go up. And of course, there's going to be all this pressure to keep wages down because the Fed will jack up interest rates. And if prices start going up, they'll jack up interest rates to drive down wages. And so it's going to make people even poorer. The working class of America, the middle class of America is going to become even poorer. And the rich are going to get richer. Whereas if you put a tax on securities, it would not inflate the dollar. It would have no effect on the dollar. If anything, it would make our economy stronger because it would cause people who are buying and selling stocks to be doing so because they want a company to become worth more, or if they're selling the stock, because they believe that the way the company is being managed or run, it's going to become worth less. It also would immediately put transparency and accountability into stock transactions, because if you have to pay a tax on it, you have to keep track of it, and you have to report it to somebody. So this is, I mean, this just seems to me like a no-brainer, and, you know, let me just put the word out there. Now, as to all this stuff happening, frankly, I think that I agree with Naomi Klein that this is the shock doctrine on steroids. I also think that the planning for this, and this is where you get one of these real whoa kind of things, you know, raise your eyebrows, is that the White House yesterday, Tony Fratto, who is the number two guy in the, you know, the assistant press secretary, the deputy press secretary. This is from roll call yesterday. Fratto insisted the plan was not slapped together and had been drawn up as a contingency over previous months. So all the time that they've been saying, oh, everything's fine, don't worry, we got everything under control, it's great, the fundamentals are strong, all that time, they had been putting together a contingency? They had been essentially planning for this? And now they want us to pay $4,780 each taxpayer? And that's the initial cost. That doesn't include the interest, by the way, because if we sell 20-year bonds, it's going to be more like $9,000, $10,000 per taxpayer, because we got to pay interest to the guys who are in China and Saudi Arabia who are going to loan us the $700 billion. They want every taxpayer to pay $9,000? Give me a break. Let Wall Street bail out Wall Street.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
I climbed across the mountain.
Four minutes past the hour, so let's just review this very quickly. The administration knew that they were creating a disaster. I would argue that the administration, in fact, created the disaster. And in a little while on the program, I'll share with you some audio from George Bush about that. Some pretty amazing audio, actually. They knew. They knew.
All Americans on their homes.
Here we are.
Yeah, we have a problem here in America because fewer than half of the Hispanics and half the African Americans own the home.
This 2002.
The home ownership gap. The gap that we've got to work together to close.
2002.
By the end of this decade, we'll increase the number of minority homeowners by at least 5.5 million families. And, of course, one of the larger obstacles to minority home ownership is financing. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have committed to provide more money for lenders. They've committed to help meet the shortage of capital available for minority home buyers. Freddie Mac recently began 25 initiatives around the country to dismantle barriers and create greater opportunities for home ownership. One of the programs is designed to help deserving families who have bad credit histories to qualify for home ownership loans.
Isn't that sweet?
You don't have to have a lousy home for first-time home buyers.
October 2002.
Put your mind to it, the first-time home buyer, the low-income home buyer, can have just as nice a house as anybody else.
Yeah. George W. Bush, October 2002. Now, the big talking point for all the right-wing cons out there is all the right-wing talking shows is, this is all because poor people bought houses that they shouldn't have bought, or people bought houses that they shouldn't have been able to buy. If that actually is part of the cause of the problem, why? Well, here, George W. Bush, the Bush administration. A disaster brought to you of, by, and for the Bush administration. Why? For disaster capitalism. They saw this coming. They set it up. They saw it coming. And frankly, I am now increasingly convinced that they did not expect this bomb to blow up until the spring of 2009 in a Democratic administration. Or frankly, from Bush's point of view, Bush, who hates John McCain, if it blew up in McCain's face, it wouldn't be all that bad a thing. That's why they're grooming Sarah Palin. Maybe it would give him a heart attack or something, get him out of the way. And Sarah Palin, who is, and as Naomi Wolf laid out so brilliantly over at the Huffington Post, if you haven't read her piece, The Battle Plan 2, Sarah Evita Palin, the muse of the coming police state, get over there now and read it. Then we would have Evita as our another Bush Cheney Rove presidency. So anyhow, let's pick up your thoughts on this thing. Andy in Georgia. Hey Andy, what's on your mind?
Hey Tom.
Hey Andy.
I want to call my congressman about the oversight regulations.
Right.
And I read Chris Dodd's plan, but I'm concerned that I might be missing something implicit in it. Section 4 of Chris Dodd talks about the Oversight Board, and it can review the exercise of authority by the Treasury Secretary, and it can make recommendations to the Secretary. There's no requirement for adherence, no power to compel. Section 8 gives limits on review. It says no action of the Secretary shall be set aside unless, quote, found to be arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion, or not in accordance with the law, unquote. Section 15 outlines a comptroller who has access to all the records and can take a corrective response, which consists of, one, he can, and the corrective response from the secretary to what the comptroller says can be either, one, take action to correct the deficiencies, or, two, certify to the comptroller that no action is necessary or appropriate. And it seems like in all of this plan, there is no power to compel the secretary, to compel the Treasury Secretary to do anything. You know, the board and the comptroller may think that the secretary is doing something wrong, but they can't make him change it. In effect, the secretary can do anything he wants still.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this language contains like some kind of implicit understanding.
I'm pretty ambivalent about it. What I'm saying, Andy, is let's just throw the whole thing out. Let's just throw the whole damn thing out and just say, if Wall Street needs money, you guys need some cash, we're going to start imposing a 0.25%, a quarter of 1% transaction fee.
How about 0.5%?
Well, actually, yeah, Dean Baker at one point had suggested 0.5% with a 0.25% going to the buyer and a 0.25% going to the seller, and I think that might be a great idea.
Right.
Let's impose a transaction fee on every stock trade, on every credit swap, on all these, on every derivative activity, on all of them. Let's just simply impose that fee, and that will generate plenty of money, and we'll use that money to start buying up bad securities. We'll use that money to start buying up bad home mortgages that are the consequence of George Bush pushing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to allow to drop lending standards, you know, to dramatically drop lending standards, apparently for political advantage for the Republicans. I mean, let's just do it like that.
Right. And so this any kind of buyout really is the wrong approach. It should be kind of a more of a bottom up thing, like you're.
Yeah, in my humble opinion, Andy, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, Clay in Portland. Hey, Clay.
Hey, Tom, I just want to comment on your SEC transaction fee thing that you're talking about. Now, I don't know the details of what was going on in 1966, because quite frankly, I was probably trading baseball cards rather than stocks. But it seems to me that right now, currently we have almost self-regulatory. We've got certain mutual fund companies that are doing some such thing, is that they're charging back-end fees for somebody that buys and sells within, let's say, 90 or 120 days.
That's
so they're
right.
Discouraging volatility and people not holding long term
within their funds,
within their own funds.
But there's nothing that's discouraging volatility in the whole system.
No, exactly, and I agree that should be something could be instituted, and maybe not for both ends of the transaction, because then you're on the buy end, you're you know, nobody's saying when they buy that they're going to be selling right away. It's on the back end, and
right.
You know, perhaps even a higher percent. But the what you really want to discourage is people just buying and selling very, very short term, or day trading and that kind of stuff. That's
yeah, basically, which is gambling, which is speculation.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
we want to do is go back to an economy where the purpose of the stock market is so that people can invest. And then come and tell me about, hey, let's allow people to have investment funds and stuff, you know, for their security, for their, you know, and these guys who want to privatize Social Security, which is a crock in the first place, because, you know, a third of Social Security payments literally go to widows and orphans and disabled people. Social Security is not an old age retirement program. It's an old age and other forms of terrible disaster poverty insurance, anti-poverty insurance. But nonetheless, yeah, absolutely. Let's stop having this be, you know, a casino. We got a casino right now where the house has taken no skin off the top. And so everybody's going, hey, let's go play in the casino. The odds are actually 50-50, you'll win or lose. Whereas if you or I walk, you know, most rational people walk into a casino and they know if they stay there long enough, they're going to have to pay a chunk of that to the house. When my dad was alive, he and my mom used to go to this Indian casino up in Michigan, about, I don't know, an hour and a half north of Lansing, Pleasant Lake, I think it was. And you know, mom would sit there and go through nickels in the slot machines for hours, knowing that she was going to end up with, you know, it was cheap entertainment. Dad calculated it. It worked out to something like $6 an hour. And they figured that was, you know, that was fun. But that's what's going to the house. I mean, because it's speculation. Sean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. I thank you so much for your program. I always look forward to it.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out something. This is the mother of all Enrons, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. Only in, you know, Enron actually was allowed to go down. It took a lot of people with it, but the people who were invested in Enron went down. There is a slight difference here, Sean. It looks like most of what has happened has been legal, whereas much of what Enron did was actually illegal, although it was set up by the same kind of deregulations and by Phil Graham and the Republicans and the same people. They pushed it into the area of illegality. And it's entirely conceivable that there's a fair amount of that out there right now. And apparently the FBI is looking into this, although I think that that's putting lipstick on a pig. I think that's trying to they're doing that because they're trying to look like they're doing something about this. But why should we be bailing them out? We shouldn't. I mean, it's just crazy. Virginia, thank you for the call. Virginia in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Virginia.
Greetings from Michigan, Grand Rapids.
I was talking to my brother yesterday who lives there, my brother Steve.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day here. Well, yeah. Anyway, I was just reading about Adam Smith, and I think this tax you're talking about would be a cost to business, and businessmen don't like costs. But they don't seem to see the bad effects of.
Well, Virginia, it wouldn't be a cost to business unless your business was speculation.
Oh,
it's because it's not a tax that is going to be put on the businesses whose stocks are being traded. It's a tax to the traders. So if your business is speculation, if your business is making money buying and selling stocks, well, even then it's not a tax. It's because they would be passed through to the people who are buying and selling the stocks. So it would just be basically, Virginia, thank you for the call. It would just be basically for the day traders and for the big corporate traders, which is an industry. but it's one that is destroying it.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Time for our voting alert for the day.
Just a touch of a screen. Welcome to the future. Come try our voting machine.
This from the League of Women Voters today. The Department of Veterans Affairs' latest directive, which modifies its misguided policy barring voter registration activities in VA facilities, is not enough. First, the directive imposes no affirmative obligation on VA facilities and agencies to register veterans. Second, the VA's directive makes voter registration services available only to patients residing in VA facilities and not to veterans availing themselves of VA services on an outpatient basis or otherwise obtaining services from the VA. Third, under the VA's directive, it is unclear whether and to what extent outside groups, which are responsible for millions of voter registrations every election, will actually be permitted to conduct voter registration activities. Finally, the VA's directive will not guarantee prompt services so veterans are able to register and vote this year. I'm telling you, they don't want us voting. And there's a reason. As Paul Weyrich said, the Republican strategist who helped put Ronald Reagan in office and is still in the seat, the old direct mail guy, Paul Weyrich said to a group of Republican Christians in a church back about 15 years ago,
"Now many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down."
And they're trying to drive down the voting populace. And we have to get active about this. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Is blogging about this over at Daily Kos and in other spots. I believe over at the Huffington Post as well, about how in some states they're going to say if your driver's license doesn't match your voter's registration, if you're missing a middle initial, if I'm registered as Thomas Hartman rather than Thomas C. Hartman or whatever, you know, that I won't be allowed to vote. Right? Now, that's not going to happen here in Oregon. We've got a very good Secretary of State, but there are states where the swing states in particular that are controlled by Republicans, or where even at the local levels things are controlled by Republicans. We've got to get active out there. Sonia in Kentucky. Hey, Sonia.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. I love listening to your show every day, and I'm glad we have someone of your caliber out there. My big problem is that I'm, you know, listening to all this, and it is so overwhelming that it just makes you feel like you're in this dream, and, you know, this Mack truck is coming towards you, and you can't move.
And that's what they want. They want to frighten us into paralysis from the mutant ninja turtle, black S&M dressed cops in Minneapolis who were threatening people as they walked by, to the whole Cheney machine, to busting Don Siegelman and others. It's all about intimidation. And Sonia, what we have to do is say, we will not be intimidated. We will not be afraid. We're going to stand up and speak out. We are going to rescue this democracy. We are going to get active. We are, you know, each one of us, we're, you know, toss some money to a political campaign, go out and register some voters, go door to door on behalf of a politician. It doesn't, you know, whoever it, well, in this election, I'd say, please don't do it for John McCain, but, you know,
oh, no.
What the heck? I mean, get involved. I think if people of goodwill actually got involved in the Republican Party and took it back from the Robians, that would be actually a good thing. I think that we need to get involved right across the board in the political process. Voting is not enough.
The
But Tom, years ago when our parents were really active, and I mean my parents were really involved in, you know, the 60s activism, but they had time to do it. I mean, the way they have us now, I mean, our jobs have us, you know, just sucked into, you know, being there and overtime and all this.
I absolutely understand, Sonia, and I think that all of us and you know, you're talking to Mr. Burnout here. This last year, I'm working 15-hour days, 7 days a week between writing a book and doing a radio show. But still, I find time to speak out at rallies, to, at the very least, send some money, you know, and don't think that $25 doesn't mean a lot, because it does, if it comes from a lot of people to a campaign. Sonia, I've got to move along, but we have to get active and we have to get involved. It's just that simple. Judith in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Judith.
Hi. I'll say this quickly and then just hang up so you can comment. I've got a couple things. First of all, I thought this was the October surprise last week. And what I think it is set up for is so that the Republicans can finally get rid of the New Deal, Social Security and Medicare, because we won't be able to pay for it. The wealthy won't pay for it.
Yep. Secondly, but see, I don't think that they intended for it to blow up now. I think they intended for it to blow up after Election Day.
That was interesting to hear that. And then the second thing, I just want to get this in so you can comment. Bob Schrum, I thought 4 years ago I was calling the DNC. You said to get involved. I call the big Democrats, all of them, back east all the time. And I said, oh, and the DNC, get rid of Bob Schrum. And I've called Barack Obama's, like you've been hearing over and over. We need hard-hitting sound bites, because that is all the mainly stupid American people understand. The other thing is, I want sound bites, finally, they're getting so dirty, from some so-called outside group on McCain and the savings and loans.
Yeah.
Then, lastly, I do agree. Two questions for you. First, I'll hang up. If a company is
we're going to actually run out of time in about 20 seconds.
Okay, if a company is so huge, why can't those CEOs and can bring down a country? Why can't they be tried for treason? Also, we need you on Lou Dobbs.
Yeah, okay.
We need you on Lou Dobbs. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. I appreciate the call. Now, just apropos of all of this stuff, we do need the big problem that Obama has is that he tends to give thoughtful answers to questions when, in fact, sound bites work better, because we live in a sound bite culture and so much is driven by television. And I believe that they're getting that. And Friday night, I am so hoping and praying that Barack Obama has some sound bites down. These guys have to, you know, on the other hand, he is acting presidential, and I think to a large extent it is working. So we'll see. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He is the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. I still like calling it a conservative news site, Terry. You don't?
Do I not call it a conservative news site?
Right.
Well, it's a news site. Am I a conservative? Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
It seems to me, let's kick around some of the topics, some of this economic stuff here that has to do with this bailout that's going to cost, $4,780 for every taxpayer in America. There's 146.44 million taxpayers. That's before interest, by the way. If these are 20-year notes, you can double that. So it's about $9,000, maybe $10,000 per taxpayer that the Republican administration wants us all to pay to bail out the banks and the billionaires. And I'm hearing that there are a lot of Republicans pushing back on this. John McCain will not say that he supports it. What's your take on that?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who are pushing back. I think there's a lot of people who would prefer not to do it. I think the big question that they're going to have to answer in the next couple of days is this something they have to do or something we don't have to do? And quite frankly, I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have been in a position where that's the question, however.
Right. What do you think got us into this?
I believe at the root of it is what economists call a moral hazard, that there are some people in government who had an interest in increasing the number of people who were able to buy homes in America. On the face of it, that's a good thing. But the way they did it was by lifting the risk off the people who are making the actual mortgages and increasing the risk of the people who were taking the mortgages. They lowered the down payment standards. They lowered the credit standards. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bought up the mortgages immediately from the people who were actually making the mortgages and then turned around and they were sold, you know, packaged as these massive bond deals, so that the people who actually cut the deal were not responsible for how it worked out in the long run.
Right, the disconnection. So it's the nasty politicians in Washington, D.C. who set this thing up. Are we in agreement on that?
Yes.
Okay, let me play you 1 minute of audio, if I may.
Sure.
Hang on a second, got to turn.
More and more people own their homes in America today. Two-thirds of all Americans own their homes. Yeah, we have a problem here in America because fewer than half of the Hispanics and half the African Americans own a home.
Let me just let you know, by the way, this is from October of 2002.
Yeah.
It's a home ownership gap. It's a gap that we've got to work together to close. And by the end of this decade, we'll increase the number of minority homeowners by at least 5.5 million families. And, of course, one of the larger obstacles to minority home ownership is financing. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have committed to provide more money for lenders. They've committed to help meet the shortage of capital available for minority home buyers. Freddie Mac recently began 25 initiatives around the country to dismantle barriers and create greater opportunities for home ownership. One of the programs is designed to help deserving families who have bad credit histories to qualify for home ownership loans. You don't have to have a lousy home for first-time home buyers. You put your mind to it, the first-time home buyer, the low-income home buyer, can have just as nice a house as anybody else.
Now, this was a packaged program. It had a logo and a brand. It was called the Ownership Society, Terry.
Yeah, is George Bush complicit in this? There's absolutely no doubt about it. And in fact, that those policies.
And every Republican in the House of Representatives, at that time, Congress was entirely controlled by the Republicans,
well,
and they were all going, yeah, gung ho. Even Newt Gingrich was 100% behind the Ownership Society.
Now, wait a minute. The specific policies you're talking about with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all Republicans in Congress were not behind. Absolutely, Bush was for what you just said, and so people understand the history of that. What happened was that Franklin Raines, who at that time was CEO of Fannie Mae, he had been the director of the Office of Management and Budget in Bill Clinton's White House. He went from there to being the chairman and CEO of Fannie Mae in January of 1999. Immediately, Franklin Raines started promoting exactly those policies that Bush later promoted, namely dropping the amount of down payment someone had to make to get a mortgage that Fannie Mae would buy, and increasing the amount of credit risk.
So you're going to blame this on the guy at the middle level rather than on the guys at the top who are making the policy.
Wait a minute. Franklin Raines was not at the middle level. He was the chairman and CEO of Fannie Mae, which is a government-sponsored enterprise, which together with Freddie Mac had in some way dealt with about half the mortgages of the United States. This was a policy that was advanced by the Clinton administration. It was advanced by the Bush administration. It kept going under the Bush administration. They were both wrong. It was, in fact, resisted aggressively by conservatives in the United States Congress and by conservative think tanks like the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation who were decrying this.
Actually, Cato was gung-ho for even more. I mean, Cato was like, do away with all the regulations. There shouldn't even be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And all the subsidies. And if you can go back and look, these guys, Heritage Foundation was calling for breaking up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right.
People need to also understand that these organizations had a line of credit with the U.S. Treasury. They said subsidized credit. They did not pay federal or state income taxes. Fannie Mae is an institution that was started as part of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, a government agency. It was privatized by Lyndon Johnson. But, yes,
correct. Right, and that was a terrible mistake. And, Terry, I think you and I can agree that it was a terrible mistake to privatize it. LBJ did that to get it off the books because he was trying to hide the cost of the war in Vietnam, frankly, and his great society. Together, he was trying to do guns and butter, and you can't do both, and that's what led to the stagflation of the 70s.
I would say, Tom, that the government never should have been in the business in the first place.
But if the government hadn't gotten in the business, Terry, my father certainly wouldn't have been able to buy a house, and probably yours wouldn't either. The whole generation of guys coming back from World War II would not have been able to buy houses without Freddie and Fannie.
There's a classic economic rule. I think history proves it, that anything government subsidizes, you get inflation in. When government subsidizes the housing market, you get inflation in housing. It also undermines the sort of virtues in a Republican society, in a free society, we need in order to get in a position to buy a house. It's hard work and thrift, saving the money and developing the credit to be able to buy a house in the free market without the government backing you up.
You know, broadly, those are concepts that I absolutely agree with. The problem that Roosevelt was facing was that he literally, I mean, when he said, I see a third of the nation ill-housed, ill-fed, ill-clothed, he was speaking the truth. I mean, people were dying in this country. There had to be a way to stimulate the economy. And that was one of the ways to do so, was to encourage home ownership. And it worked, by the way. It worked until, as you correctly point out, people like Lawrence Summers and you know, some of these guys in the Clinton administration, and then the guys in the Bush administration came along and said, and Phil Graham came along and said, let's deregulate all this stuff. This is silly. We shouldn't have all these rules.
What they deregulated was exactly what the liberals wanted. They said, if you can't get a 20% down payment, if you have an impaired credit history, we'll still buy up your mortgage. That is a form of the welfare state, Tom. And another thing that was wrong with this is we had consolidation into essentially...
Terry, I don't recall any liberals pushing for this. I recall Phil Graham pushing for this.
No, excuse me. Bill Clinton pushed for this. Andrew Cuomo, who was head secretary, pushed for this. Franklin Raines pushed for this. James Johnson, who preceded Franklin Raines as chairman of Fannie Mae and was the vice presidential chooser for Kerry and for Obama,
I'll give you all those guys, Terry. I would say none of those guys are liberals, first of all, but I'll give you all those guys. What are we going to do? Here's my proposal, that we simply go back to the tax that we had, and I know I say tax and immediately your ears perk up, that we had in the United States from 1914 that was put into place to pay for World War One and stayed on the books until 1966, when I believe LBJ was president, took it off, in 66, that a quarter of 1% tax is added to every transaction, every sale or purchase of stock. And what that does is it causes people, number one, if we did that today, it would create $160 billion a year instantly. And number two, what it does is it causes people to say, okay, I'm going to buy this stock because the company is going to increase in value, not because, gee, if I can buy 100,000 shares of the stock, it'll look like there's more activity in the stock, it'll drive the price up, more people will buy it, my stock will become worth more tomorrow, and then I can sell it day after tomorrow at a higher price. In other words, it'll stop speculation, it'll cause investment. In fact, most of your funds, you know, like most of the big, funds, you know, where you can buy into mutual funds, have this kind of a rule for people like you and me within the fund.
Right. I don't know about that policy.
It increases moral hazard.
But I will tell you where I'd like to go. I don't know how we get there. If you have people who actually make the loans have to, they hold the loans and they take the risk of those loans.
Yes.
It would work.
I agree with you. And in fact, let's go back to local banks. But can we pick up the conversation on the other side of the break here, Terry? Terry?
Yeah, I'm here.
Stick around for the break, okay?
All righty.
We're talking with Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, and kind of a left versus right conversation about what to do about this. What to do about this mess brought to us courtesy of, well, at least the last two administrations.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ooh. There you go. Hank Paulson's new song. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, and a rational conservative, which is really nice, Terry. I appreciate your coming on the show here. And in the last segment, you said that the conservatives and that you and other conservatives were in favor of there being strong government regulations on who could get a home mortgage, which somehow doesn't seem to me consistent with conservative philosophy.
No, that's not exactly what I'm saying, Tom. What was happening is you had these two government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who were driving the mortgage market determined by the rules they set for the mortgages they would purchase from the organizations that were actually making them.
But they weren't the only ones doing it. Freddie and Fannie only accounted for what, $5 trillion worth of mortgages?
Half the mortgages in the United States went through those two organizations.
So the other half were not. And a lot of that other half are the really bad ones. I mean, a lot of these really toxic ones are the ones that are coming out of these little mortgage companies that sprang up, many of which have now gone bankrupt. I mean, that's one of the reasons why so much of this stuff is now toxic.
Well, if they go bankrupt, that's fine. What's the problem is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not allowed to go bankrupt because they were too big. But my point is that they drove the standards in the market because they were the 800-pound gorilla.
So if we're going to break up the big guys, so again, you're calling for government regulation.
I'm not.
The big guys.
I'm saying for government to get out of it. I'm saying that at the root of this is that you had politicians like you played the audio from George W. Bush.
Right.
You had President Clinton, Andrew Cuomo, Franklin Reince, George W. Bush all saying the same thing for the same political reason. They're saying, we're going to help you buy a home. And the way we're going to help you buy a home is relaxing the rules that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are government-sponsored entities that get special credit from the government. So they relaxed the rules. They brought in all these bad mortgages. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac turned around and marketed them as mortgage-backed securities that all these investors...
But see, that's only the beginning of it. Then, in addition to that, the rules on securities trading were done away or were largely relaxed, and that's where we get to Graham Bliley Leach or Graham Leach Bliley or whatever it was, and so not only did these securities get packaged into bundles and sold,
right,
but then people sold bets on whether the value of those bundles would go up or down, called derivatives.
But the reason those investment banks were buying those things is because they were coming out of the government. They believe, you go back, I did a LexisNexis search, Tom, a few weeks ago. You put the word implicit guarantee in LexisNexis and you'll get up hundreds of stories about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Because all the major news stories said they carried an implicit government guarantee.
Now, see, and this is where I'm saying, this is where government did it right for a long time, and then you guys got a hold of it and broke it. And by you guys, I include the Clinton administration. And maybe I shouldn't personalize it to you, Terry, but you know, it worked well under the way that Roosevelt set it up. This was government doing what government does well, was making it possible for Americans to own homes. And then when it got privatized or semi-privatized, and you're absolutely right, Terry, it shouldn't have been, you know, we're going to privatize the profits and we're going to socialize the downside, the risk.
But here's the
ultimate question. If the danger to our society is any company getting so big it can't afford to fail, why shouldn't we be enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act? Senator Sherman from Ohio, by the way, was a Republican.
If you actually look at the real economy, every time you get one of these corporate behemoths that gets too big, we can't fail, it's essentially because of the government. That's the situation with Boeing. That's the situation with these investment banks. And I tell you, when Franklin Roosevelt started Fannie Mae, he started a ticking time bomb that's exploding now. Franklin Roosevelt started Social Security. That's another.
No, I would say both of those. Social Security, by the way, is not even going to have a problem for 43 years.
Time bomb. And LBJ started the ticking time bomb of Medicare. And if people think that this is a financial crisis and this is a bailout, wait until they see the bailout for those two big.
Well, if the Republicans in Congress who pushed through things like, you know, Medicare can't negotiate for the cost of drugs, if you guys continue to sabotage these programs, yeah, they're going to go down in flames.
It's not me. I'm for privatization of Medicare and Social Security. I am for privatization of those things. I do not want people dependent on the government for their health care.
But you do want them dependent on a CEO. that you do want them dependent on William Maguire, the guy who took $1.78 billion.
In the free market. I don't want them dependent on corporate socialism. Listen, who had a big interest
in United Healthcare is not taking government money. It's a health insurance company. It paid its CEO over a billion dollars.
Medicare is corporate socialism. Just like,
I'm not talking about Medicare. I'm talking about United Health. I'm talking about this. I don't want to depend on CEOs and corporations beholden to stockholders for my health care.
Well,
if I've got a complaint about how my health care is delivered, I want to be able to throw somebody out of office over it.
Not me. I want to fire my health care provider and get a new one in the free market.
Yeah, assuming that the new one is there.
There'll be one there if there's a free market. If there's not, it'll just be the government, and you'll have to go beg Barack Obama to get you a doctor.
Okay, we will let you have the final word on that, Terry. Thanks a lot for dropping by. Terry Jeffries, CNSNews.com. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Chris Snyder, the senior post producer for Darker Projects, sends us this little clip.
I know that there's been tremendous turmoil in our financial markets in Wall Street, and people are frightened by these events. Our economy, I think, still... Fundamentals of our economy are strong. The fundamentals of our economy are at risk. Strong at risk. Strong 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 risk.
Strong risk. Strong risk. Strong risk. Strong risk. Strong risk. Strong risk. Strong risk. Strong risk. On the radio, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Chris in Cave Creek, Arizona. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I love that. This presidential debate problem, the vice presidential debate problem, is not getting covered. On October 2nd, the McCain people have pushed the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates to basically ignore the old rules and make these new ones for her that are limiting their responses to 30 seconds, direct exchanges between the candidates aren't allowed. They're afraid that she's too inexperienced a debater to deal with the situation.
Right, but she's ready to be president. There's a woman who spent 85 days in office as the governor, spent a couple hundred days working from home and being paid for it. I'm not sure what you do working for home when you got five kids. I guess it can be kind of busy. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. Even worse, she has spent a total of what, 39 seconds? Was it 29 or 39 seconds yesterday with reporters, allowing reporters to talk with her or to be in the room
pictures.
With her? Yeah, yeah.
To take pictures.
Yeah, it's like they're and then. Here's where it gets into the realm of the surreal, Chris. The most recent survey showed 49% approval of her across the United States.
Oh, I mean, no.
Yeah, 49% approval of Sarah Palin. It's like they are relying on there being no bad news to cause people to think that it's good news.
I'm going to keep making media clips like the one I made for you there with that McCain blowing up, and maybe I...
Oh, you're the Chris who blew that up?
Yeah, I did that.
Oh, what a weird coincidence that I went to your call right after I played your clip. I had no idea.
Well, it was just something I made for the local show that I host on the weekend, that I work for on the weekends here on our progressive station here in Phoenix, KPHX, Action Point. But it was just because I couldn't believe it. I heard him say that, and I went, my head is exploding. And then I went, oh, that's really going to work.
Yeah, it really did. Chris, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. It's fascinating. Fascinating. Weldon in Minneapolis. Hey, Weldon.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick comment. Whenever you have Terry Jeffers on, my head just about explodes because these Republicans, even when you agree with Republicans, it seems that they do things, some things, but they do it for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And he cited Clinton's, advocacy for getting minorities into houses during his presidency, but the Republicans pervert it into something else.
Right.
Because they're just money hungry and greedy.
Right. Bottom line is what Clinton was saying, or what was said during the Clinton administration. I don't have a direct quote from Bill Clinton, but I think the sentiment actually that started with LBJ and the Great Society was, we need to do everything that we can to make sure that housing is available to people all across America, regardless of their race, regardless of their religion, regardless of where they happen to live, whether it's a depressed area or not. And how do we do that in a way that's rational and reasonable? What the Republicans did is they looked at that and they said, okay, how do we use that rhetoric to create a Ponzi scheme where our buddies, who are our main campaign donors, can make a whole pile of money?
Yeah, and the thing is that, and I wish you would press this point a little more, is that that is a specific fascist thing to do, is to, and it's Orwellian because, they take one phrase and they promote it one way and it's like doublethink, they say, okay, well, we'll get minorities into houses, but on the other level, they're secretly, trying to promote
it's
poverty
disaster
in the country.
Yeah, and it's disaster capitalism.
And,
excellent point, Weldon. Excellent.
And now you have this guy from Louisiana on Think Progress who just came out with a report advocating for eugenics because welfare is systemic among the poor, and it's like all tied into this again.
Yeah. Yeah, we're back to the 19th century all over again, and well said. Thank you very much, Weldon. And broadly speaking, particularly with Terry, I don't try to beat him over the head so much. I think that most of you get it, what's going on. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Deborah in Phoenix. Hey, Deborah.
Hey, how are you?
Good. You have loan underwriting details?
Yeah. I wanted to go back to what that woman said before. I was an underwriter for about 23 years, and I was in the back end, which does all the security, all the securities and all the notes and all the packages that go into the bank. And there's a couple of things that I wanted to say about that. When all this stuff started to spin out of control before we actually had the subprime loans, the underwriters were able to make their own decisions. You had to be certified. You had to be able to make decisions on the full file.
Right.
Then you'd have to go to training, and like probably about 10 years ago when they came out with the automated systems for not only Freddie and Fannie, but a couple of years later, then FHA followed and sued, and so did VA.
Right.
Now what happened about a year ago or 2 years ago or maybe a little longer, when they got what they call the all-day loans, which is what started this whole nightmare, we were not able to make decisions anymore. We had to follow guidelines to the T. So we could go to someone and say, hey, to your manager, this loan doesn't look good, we don't want to do it, and they'd say, you either do it or we'll sign off on it. So there was no in-between anymore. We couldn't make up our mind. We couldn't do any risk, and then there wasn't any information. If you had a good FICO score, that was the end of it.
Right.
You could get a loan, and it was ridiculous. I mean, for years, people were complaining, and I could see it coming, and I kept saying, I don't know why we're doing this, but nobody...
Well, let me get this straight, because if somebody has a good FICO score, then presumably they're good credit risk, and they should be able to get a loan. I mean,
right.
why is it bad to have a system that says that, I remember when we first moved to Atlanta in 1983, real estate person, salesperson who showed Louise around, the first question she asked was, do you want to live in a whites-only area or a mixed area?
Right.
And Louise was so offended, she got out of the car. And,
right.
But that's how it was in 1983. And
right.
So why not say people like that can't make decisions like that, can't make statements like that. If somebody's got a decent credit score, they get a mortgage.
Right. Well, what happened is they took the credit scores and that was it. No phone number, no job. If you put that through automated underwriting, it would come back with nothing on it. So you didn't even have to make sure that these people were working.
Right.
And then what happened is they came up with these programs for HUD and the you know, first and second mortgages where nobody had to even walk in with a dime. In some cases, they even got money back.
Right, the ninja loans. So what you're saying is that it didn't go the way that I was suggesting would actually make some sense, that instead it went that way, but to a level of absurdity that guaranteed this implosion.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then there was also private investors that weren't even Fannie and Freddie, you know, that would actually buy these, you know, subprime loans and then they would privatize them on their own, and they'd be private investors that had nothing to do with Fannie and Freddie, because Fannie and Freddie would do the regular type loans. And then there was waivers, you know. I mean, these big companies like Countrywide, they were allowed to have their own automated system, their own way of doing it through Fannie. So they were giving out waivers like crazy, saying, well, you're a big company, you're solvent. Here, you can do this, you can do that, you can do this.
Yeah,
it was crazy.
This was the Bush administration thinking, and the Republicans in Congress in the fall of 2002 thinking that you know, all the cautionary principles, all the essentially moral risk principles that were built into the system could be thrown out and it would still work, because they didn't understand how the system worked.
That's exactly right.
Deborah, thank you very much. That's excellent. I appreciate the call. Peter in Staten Island, New York. Hey, Peter.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I had two things I wanted to say. First, I think Warren Buffett today showed the way that the negotiations could take place when he asked for a 10% drop in the price plus a warrant to exchange what he buys a year from now. I'd like to have someone offer him as the person to be, or people like him, the intermediary on behalf of the taxpayer when these final packages are put together after this whole package gets passed.
Well, what Warren Buffett is doing is he's saying, okay, let's see. The guy who had $700 million worth of Goldman Sachs stock and who worked for Goldman Sachs for 16 years is now the Treasury Secretary, and he's getting a $700 billion pool of money that he can bail out anybody he wants with under any circumstances. Who's going to be at the top of his list? Goldman Sachs. So I think I'll buy Goldman Sachs cheap right now, because pretty soon it's going to be worth a whole lot more. Warren Buffett's just being a smart investor.
Well,
or an opportunist.
That's who we need to operate on behalf of the taxpayer. That's my first comment. My second comment is, fast forward to a potential time where we're sitting back.
Let me just challenge that, Peter. The Warren Buffett is acting on behalf of Warren Buffett, and that's his whole thing. And yes, it would be good to have somebody acting on behalf of the taxpayer who's saying, you know, we're going to defend the interests of the taxpayer. And Warren Buffett, in fact, is a reasonably good liberal. But frankly, I just don't think we should even be in that business. We need to put a tax on trades or stock. Just make it really simple.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Welcome back. The Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. Heather Volkusch is on the line with us from Austria. Yeah, the country over there in Europe. Hey, Heather, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you again.
I want to plug your Progressives Handbook, brilliant book, progressiveshandbook.com, great website, particularly for people who can't remember how to spell your last name, which is starts with a W, even though in German that's pronounced with a V, W-O-K-U-S-C-H, Heather Volkusch. .com is how an American would probably try to think of it, and progressiveshandbook.com. Heather, it looks like there is a war between the U.S. and Pakistan, and Iran. I mean, we have a mess here.
It is absolutely unbelievable. You're absolutely right.
And it's totally under the radar.
It's
totally under the radar and totally uncalled for, and one of the most dangerous things we're facing right now. It's just amazing. This month alone has been insane. You have U.S. commandos. They're entering border villages and killing people. On September 3rd, they killed 20 people, including women and children. 3 days later, you have a new president elected in Pakistan. And then the army says, okay, it will allow itself to open fire if the U.S. launches a raid across the Afghan border. So, you know, there's all of this stuff going on.
You know, here you had Wajid Samsul Hassan. He's the ambassador to the United Kingdom, Pakistan's ambassador to the U.K. Yesterday said that U.S. raids into Pakistani territory were why the Marriott was bombed. So,
yeah.
You know, and it wasn't even reported in the U.S. media that this guy came out and said this.
Reported in the U.S. media, but you know there's other things being reported in the Pakistan media that are arguably even more terrifying. Now we have to put this into context that, you know, on Saturday first, you know, this new president Zardari gave his first speech to Parliament, and he basically said Pakistan is not going to tolerate any of these violations of its sovereignty. Hours later, the hotel blew up, right? Well, it turns out that in this Marriott hotel, there had been a parliamentarian, Pakistani parliamentarian, and others that night, and they witnessed before this the U.S. military removing very large steel boxes from a U.S. embassy truck and taking them to the fourth or the fifth floor, it was reported that night. And so now there's a lot of speculation in different, you know, Pakistan media about, well, was this an attack by U.S. forces or was it against U.S. forces? And of course, this little known Islamic group, you know, Fedayeen Islam, claims responsibility, but some people are wondering, well, is this just a front? So there's really a lot of questions.
So the conspiracy theory, as it were, in Pakistan is, did the Marines, U.S. Marines, blow up the Marriott?
Or did some group blow it up because the Marines were there? You know what I thought was really interesting, Tom, is that 2 years ago tomorrow, was the day that the former president, Musharraf, was on 60 Minutes saying that he'd been warned by the U.S. government to either help the U.S. on its war on terror or, quote, be bombed back to the Stone Age. That was 2 years ago tomorrow, and so it's a very weird, weird thing that we got going on.
So we're conducting military operations in Pakistan on an ongoing basis, and the government is saying, no, we won't have it. The people are saying, no, we won't have it. We have both presidential candidates supportive of U.S. unilateral military operations in Pakistan. If, you know, the caveat that Obama puts on it, and I'm assuming this is a similar caveat in McCain's part, is that if they know that that's where Osama bin Laden is, he's such a grand boogeyman. Do I have this right?
Yeah, you sure do. That's a big if. And the one thing that's even just more bizarre about this is, how did we start doing this? Well, in July, Bush gave himself the power to, you know, go into Pakistan and carry out ground assaults or do anything that he wanted to. This is a classified order that the New York Times reported on, actually, September 11th. And so this is why he's doing this. And Defense Secretary Gates is saying that when he was questioned about this, he said, well, I'm assuming that the appropriate international law has been followed. So, you know, it's just insane. But we have to keep in mind, Pakistan has between, you know, 40 and 100 nuclear warheads.
Right.
And so this is absolutely not the country that we should be destabilizing. It's really terrifying.
What, you know, from the European perspective and from your perspective, for which I have tremendous respect, Heather Volkush, what do you think the possibilities or probabilities are that the Pakistani government is going to flip so nationalist so hard that they may realign themselves with Russia or with China or even with Iran and go off on their own?
Well, actually, Tom, that's a very good question, because just days ago, the military commander of Pakistan headed right out to China for talks. And this has been, you know, a very long time. So I would say right here in Europe right now, what people are more concerned about now is the economic meltdown, because in the States, this is totally bringing down the European economy. This is also underneath the radar here. But I really feel that this is going to be the potential war front that we need to look at. I mean, this could put, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan completely off the map, given the fact that we've got these 40 to 100 nuclear warheads in Pakistan. Very important issue.
Yeah. So, oh my, okay.
Yeah, mind-boggling, isn't it? And
yeah.
All of this is happening.
In the 60 seconds we have left here, we're talking with Heather Volkush, by the way. Website's progressiveshandbook.com, and Heather, as if it were Wokush, Wokush.com, for her writings. this other war front. But and how, you know, in Europe they're concerned. I heard that three countries, France, Germany, and England, have come out and said that they don't need their banks bailed out by the U.S. Treasury. And yet you're saying that the Europeans are very concerned about the financial meltdown here in the U.S.
Well,
the
they're concerned because the EU officially now has gone into recession. And so they don't want anything, you know, bailed out by the U.S. They don't trust the U.S. system at all. I mean, especially since they stopped releasing money supply data in 2003.
Right.
But what they're trying to do is just keep themselves afloat, which is a kind of a scary thing. And so here, that's what everybody's focused on.
So they're concerned about a Great Depression going worldwide like it did in 1932. 31.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I would invite your listeners to come and watch my YouTube video on my site. It kind of goes into Pakistan and the economy.
Great, and people can find that over Heather Vokush, HeatherWokush.com. Heather, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And thanks for the call from Austria. It's always great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Alex Epstein. We're going to talk with the Ayn Rand Center.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, beloved leader is going to speak to the nation tonight at 9 o'clock. I'm sure you're tremendously reassured. He's going to let us all know, you know, something. As you heard earlier, to the extent that the conservatives are saying that changing lending standards caused this problem, he's the guy who was the prime cheerleader for and taking the credit for changing the lending standards back in October of 2002. Ben Stein, by the way, writing, this is interesting. He says, in fact, he's talking about these subprime mortgages. He says, in fact, these losses may be so large, one might well wonder if the whole subprime fiasco was not just set up to allow speculators to profit wildly on its collapse. Which brings us to the idea of a completely wild west, wide open market. And Alex Epstein, with the Ayn Rand Institute, ayn rand.org, the website. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here. I think we could very much use a free, quote, wild market, given what your government centrally planned market has wrought us so far.
Well, you know, I would say that the extent to which this thing may be melting down is the extent to which a functional government has been broken by people who, to a large extent, are running around citing Ayn Rand. Now, Ayn Rand, you know, in Atlas Shrugged, and to a lesser extent in The Fountainhead, and to a larger extent in some of the papers that she wrote and short articles, is, you know, the one who dreamed of a nation where basically all the government did was provide a military and a court system to make sure that there was no fraud, if I have that right.
Right, no, definitely that's true, but I don't remember Ayn Rand's imprimatur on, say, the Community Reinvestment Act, the charters for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the creation or sustaining of the Federal Reserve, although, of course, Alan Greenspan was wrote an article about how the Federal Reserve shouldn't exist and then proceeded to abandon that belief.
Well, and he also,
and become a central plan.
In 1956, was inducted into Ayn Rand's group in her apartment. When she died, he brought a six-foot-tall, dollar-bill-shaped floral wreath to her funeral.
Right. He had not yet been a central planner of the country by then. So certainly, I mean, she was a major opponent of the Federal Reserve and obviously of all these other welfare institutions that created the corrupt non-market incentives and securities that are responsible for this whole meltdown. So you've got a combination of centrally planned money supply, centrally planned interest rates, centrally planned welfare housing agencies. So it's curious to call it a failure of the free market. It's in fact a very clear-cut failure of the unfree market.
Well, I would say it's the corruption of the market, because there's no such thing as a free market. You can't, you yourself would have to acknowledge that you can't have a market without a court system to enforce rules, and somebody has to decide what those rules are.
Right.
Somebody has to define what fraud is.
Right. Those rules can either be based on the factual requirements of what it takes for human beings to survive and flourish, which includes the freedom from the initiation of physical force, or they can be based on arbitrary notions like the common good or property is theft or, you know, whatever Marxist or liberals or conservatives.
But see, that's the problem, Alex, is that people are going to have a dispute and always have about what it is, what does it take for people to actually be able to live? At what point is this a we society versus a me society? What, for example, name one country where your ideal has ever worked in the history of the human race.
Well, certainly to the extent my ideal has been implemented, it's worked everywhere. It certainly worked in the United States. You had the fastest wealth creation period in history in the 19th century, and that was even only a fraction of what's possible under freedoms. And you can look at any market.
You're talking about the beginning of the Industrial Revolution?
Sure. Let's take from 1860 to 1900. I mean, that's just an enormous period of growth, the standard of living. Even
you know, I could point to the exact same thing after the Black Death in Europe, Alex. When you have a third of the population or a third of the working population killed off or wounded, you're going to see an explosion in economic activity because the cost of labor is driven up. And that's what happened during Reconstruction and after the Civil War.
So that's,
and not only that, we had a huge technological increase.
That's why slave labor created so much productivity in the South and they were so wealthy. Oh, wait.
No, obviously, I'm an opponent of slave labor as you are.
Okay, but you're saying it's economically beneficial, whereas I'm saying it's the liberation of individuals, which is what exists.
But most individuals in America in the late 19th century did not feel liberated. You know, in 1900, the average per capita wealth in today's dollars was around $10,000 per family, per household. People were poor in the United States.
That would make most people in history green with envy. And you had even, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I was just reading about a period where in some 10 or 20 year period, the standard of living went up by 50%. I mean, this is, if you look at the progress of the different industries back then, it's absolutely staggering how in 1859, most of the population couldn't afford to light up their homes and had to effectively sleep 12 hours a day. And by 1864, only 5 years later, people across the country in rural areas, even poor people, could light their houses cheaply thanks to oil industry.
Because in 1856, Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in the history of the world. In Titusville, Pennsylvania.
1859, but what's the point?
That it had nothing to do with libertarianism or, for that matter, liberalism.
I'll send you a copy
with an energy revolution.
Forthcoming article on this subject. No, there was a very alive and well illuminating industry dating back to the 1830s and even before, involving animal fats, involving whale oil, and then involving coal oil. Well before petroleum was an industry. So in even those industries had an incredibly fast period of growth. So if you want to go back to 1830, you went from people just surviving on animal fat for a little
bit. But in the 1840s, go back and look at the price of whale oil.
It's the freedom that enabled the discovery of the value of animal fats and then turpentine as an illuminant.
I'm a big fan of marketplaces, Alex. You know, I'm not a communist. I'm really not. I'm a big fan of marketplaces. And if you go back and you look at the price of whale oil from the 1800s until the 1860s, there are some people who suggest that the cost of the dramatically increasing cost of whale oil, which was the principal thing that was used to light homes for illumination in the United States in that period from the 1830s to the 1860s, and the price doubled a couple of times during that two-decade period, was one of the things that drove the Great Recession, some would say the Great Depression of the 1850s, that many scholars argued led directly to the Civil War. So
most of that is incorrect, and so that requires a little more thorough investigation of the history. The dominant illuminant from 1840s on was based on turpentine. It was called camphene, and there were different classes of whale oil, but they certainly went up in price, and that was an incentive. But if you look
and what
at,
it did is it brought up it opened an opportunity for oil. I mean,
the bottom line is that under capitalism, thanks to the freedom to produce, trade, own property, etc., the oil industry emerged in the United States. It brought light to millions of people, whereas, say, in Canada, which is a country you have long looked to as an example of how to conduct a government, they tried to start an oil industry there. But guess what? The Crown dictated that, well, we believe that, that property rights belong to the group, so you're not allowed to explore for oil.
We're importing oil from Canada right now.
Well,
but Alex, let's get to the core.
They've changed their ways to be more capitalist.
I see. Let's get to the core issue here. You have asserted that laissez-faire, that unregulated, unrestricted capitalism, is a just system of governance, and democracy is an immoral form of governance. And I would submit to you that laissez-faire capitalism, or any form of capitalism, is an economic system, not a governance system, and that democracy is a governance system and not an economic system.
So that's your answer?
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. So then we just have to clarify what I mean. So let me just be a little bit more exact about that. Right, so laissez-faire capitalism, you can say, is an economic system. But what that really means is that that's a combination of a certain type of governing structure and then what individuals do within that structure and the broader economy that arises from it. So if we were to make it completely parallel, you're right, it's capitalism versus democracy isn't exactly the parallel. The parallel
is close.
It's individual rights, which then leads to capitalism, but it's individual rights versus democracy.
But so individual rights are at the core of democracy.
Protecting, no, it's not. It's the antithesis of democracy, because the essence of democracy is unlimited majority rule. Now, you can say, and I've heard you say that.
And the majority is made up of individuals.
The majority is certainly made up of individuals. Many things are made up of individuals. That doesn't make them individualistic. When individuals are enslaved, that doesn't make it individual rights or individualistic. So, no, under individual rights, the individual is free to produce, trade, deal with others voluntarily. And the only thing he
fail,
may not
die.
Do is initiate. Well, everyone is free to die. And he may not initiate force, and that allows him to produce and to earn what he can on a free market.
So we should just do away with democracy and replace it with capitalism.
No, we should have voting limited to choosing the representatives to protect our rights, not to choosing who lives and who dies and whatever else the mob wants.
Okay. Alex Epstein, AynRand.org, the website, the Ayn Rand Institute. Thanks, Alex. Alex Epstein.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing. Stop treating us as spies. Save our jobs from leaving. Bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who paved your way.
21 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, your radio support group for We the People. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes even, as the Firesign Theater says, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
That thinks that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Dr. Rodney Stark, award-winning author, distinguished professor of the social sciences, co-director of the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University, a former research sociologist at the University of California, Berkeley's Survey Research Center and the Center for the Study of Law and Society. The new book, What Americans Really Believe. Dr. Rodney Stark, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
You guys did some surveys of Americans, you know, what Americans really believe. I guess it's pretty explicit. And found some interesting things. First of all, megachurches. This is something frankly, my experience kind of supports. Now, these were kind of New Age megachurches as opposed to fundamentalist megachurches, but one in Detroit and one in San Diego. I was the fill-in pastor at one Sunday and have spoken at the other a couple of times. And my hit is that these megachurches, these were congregations of, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 people at least, was that there was intense social interaction, more so than I saw even in small churches.
And you're absolutely right. The conventional view, I suspect most people who know anything about megachurches I never quote in the press that it's to say the people who write about them have never been there except maybe for one great big mega Sunday service, you know, along with the symphony orchestra and everything.
Right.
And they reach a lot of false conclusions. I think this feels like a theater audience to me, and maybe that's what it's all about. It's all hoopla. As a matter of fact, what we found, we asked people how many of their best friends were members of their congregation. That's much, much higher in the mega churches than it is in small churches.
Right. But that would, I mean, you've got a lot larger cohort to draw from, though.
Sure.
I mean,
there's... the other thing is, of course, that's how they got there.
Right.
I mean, their friends brought them, and they in turn have brought their friends, and you know, that's how these institutions are built.
You know, we have historically, as a race, as a species, pulled together by virtue of tribe, community, clan. You look at for example, the Mormon doctrine of everybody has to have is a 6 months or a year's worth of food and stashed in their basement, and water and things, you know, for the
right.
end times to come, and it's actually starting to make sense right now, given the economics of the day, that having community, having a strong community that is centered around something larger than yourself, and faith certainly is that for many people, might be a very, very healthy thing, actually.
Yeah, well, I think that the mental, I mean, there's an enormous emerging literature on health and mental health, and it's unanimous that people who go to church and are regularly involved in these communities are simply much better off for it. They aren't loners. They do have support.
And yet at the same time, in Denmark, in Sweden, in Switzerland, Switzerland's probably not the best example, but in the Scandinavian countries in particular, you find church attendance rates in some cases in the single digits.
Yes.
Typically below 20% anyway.
Usually in Scandinavia, usually below 10.
Yeah, and yet the self-reported quality of life, self-reported happiness, strength of relationships, durability of families, sturdiness of families, strength of communities are all higher than any of the indices that you can find anywhere in the United States.
I don't agree. They have extraordinarily high suicide rates, for example.
Well, they would assert to you that that is associated with the long, dark winters and seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah, well, in those long, dark winters, apparently they haven't got enough of this community you're talking about.
No, but see, we have the same problem in Alaska. You've got megachurches in Alaska, and you have very high suicide rates there.
Yeah, well, you know what we said about Alaska. Some young women saying, because of the sex ratio, you know, the odds are good, but the goods are odd.
I think that's a bit of a glib answer.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but it gets to the point that Alaska has an awful lot of people who went there because they weren't happy, who were trying to find something and didn't find it. Whereas Sweden and Norway are a bunch of people who didn't go anywhere and are sitting behind. You know, there are a lot of people who run around talking about the good social health somehow is Scandinavia, but if you look at real data, it doesn't bear up.
Well, if you look at the good social health of the Mediterranean, then. I mean, you look at Malta, for example. Here you've got an island community that has
right.
very low church attendance and very high social cohesion.
That's
and,
right.
And they don't have a high suicide rate.
Certainly, the churches aren't the only places where people can have social relations or good feelings. Certainly not.
So is it that our mega churches have become the institutions around which we're forming community simply because a suburban landscape prevents anything else?
No, I don't think so. I think that mega churches are just one aspect of all sorts of things going on in modern life.
Fascinating stuff. Dr. Stark, I'm sorry we're out of time, but people can check it out. What Americans Believe, is there a website? RodneyStark.com is the website. Got it. Dr. Stark, thanks so much for being with us.
Fine.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Viagra for your brain does not lead to stiff thinking, however. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Phil in Wayridge, Colorado. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hey, Tommy, this item is about Marshall Gardner documentary tapes, which will blow your socks off. It gives a credible inside expose on the Pentecostal religion from his perspective. People not knowing about Marshall Gardner, he was a famous motion picture actor, and he was a famous Pentecostal pastor. And I saw him as a child, and he was a child. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of Pentecostal faith and the Bible.
Is your concern about this animated by Sarah Palin's being a Pentecostalist?
Yes, I am, because you're not going to understand her unless you understand their religion.
You're right.
And if there's anybody that can get hold of these tapes, I saw them about 17 or 18 years ago. I think they should be put on YouTube or somewhere.
Yeah. You want to give his name again, Phil?
Marjo, M-A-R-J-O-E, Gartner, G-O-R-T-N-E-R.
Okay, great. Well,
we'll take a look for it. Put him on Google and you'll find it.
Okay, Phil, thank you very much. That's fascinating. I know that Naomi Wolf had put together, or some people working with her had put together, some videos of Sarah Palin's church, and YouTube took them down. And so, Sean in Vancouver. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom, you're the man for playing those Bush Ownership Society quotes.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. This was a Republican brand. Complete with a logo and a slogan. And nobody in the corporate media is revisiting this. And they're letting the conservative talk show hosts run around going, oh, this was all the liberals, this was all the Democrats. And the deregulation of these industries, or the re-regulation to the point where it was a ticking time bomb, was done by the Bushies.
That's right. And don't most historians and even conservatives agree that if it hadn't been for the New Deal, capitalism would be a footnote in the history books by now?
It may well be. I mean, Roosevelt was walking a very, very thin line. On the one hand, he had people who were openly calling for fascism, saying, hey, because this was long before World War II, saying, hey, it looks like Mussolini's doing a pretty good job over there in Italy, and Franco in Spain, you know, hey, they're making the trains run on time, which, by the way, is a myth, but nonetheless, it was the myth. And on the other hand, he had people saying, you know, what the Bolsheviks did looks like a pretty good deal. Maybe we should be, you know, talking to Joe Stalin and doing something like what he's doing. And you had genuine communists and socialists. And by the way, tomorrow we're going to have the Socialist Party's candidate for president on the show, and I'll be debating her. I mean, here I am. I think that most of America is not extreme left, socialist or communist, and not extreme right, Republican and Bill Clinton Democrat.
At the same time, though, Tom, don't you feel like we're just being sold down the river that lifting the oil drilling ban, and then Robert Rubin and all those, all those Laura Paulson, all those Clinton types standing up with Barack? I was so disappointed the other day to see that.
Yes and no. At a certain level, I would much rather see Barack Obama surround himself with all the very best friends of Russ Feingold.
Absolutely.
And Bernie Sanders. On the other hand, let's keep in mind that when Franklin Roosevelt ran for president, he ran for president on a platform of balancing the budget by cutting federal spending. The first thing he did, his first week in office, the first thing he did was cut back on the pensions to war widows.
Mm-hmm.
It was Franklin Roosevelt was no progressive in 1932. He was a progressive by 3 months into his presidency, because what happened was he realized that the people were not going to put up with that crap, that the people were demanding change. The people were demanding that the government actually become active and proactive, and he became a great president. He stepped into that. Here's, in fact, Roosevelt. You know, this is what he literally was seeing.
I certainly hope we get that with Obama. But, Tom, the reason I called, though, was there's a guy named Blackman who wrote a book called Slavery by Another Name. I just thought that libertarian creep should probably read it. Basically, it makes the point that slavery continued after the Civil War. It just went on by another name. But also, yeah. Tom, there was a guy who appeared on Kudlow and Company named Lee Picard, and he was... He was telling Larry Kudlow that they changed the capital to leverage ratio in 2004. Even though the Democrats did go along with Glass-Steagall, it was the Republicans under SEC Chairman Cox who said that these companies could leverage themselves 30 to 40 times.
That's interesting. I didn't know the details of that.
Lee Picard, it was in the New York Sun.
Yeah, okay, I'll have to track it down. Sean, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Dave in Long Beach, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This whole Republican memes, which is the only way they could defend themselves in this housing crisis, is that it was forced upon the industry.
Right.
Now, yeah, if that's true, there's only two scenarios where that could have played out. The real-world scenario and the fantasy scenario. The real-world scenario would be, you know, that industry acted like industry always acts. They went to Congress and said, okay, you're going to give us subsidies, you know, you're going to give us trade-offs, and, you know, we'll agree to this, and everybody else, you know, is a level playing field. Everybody's got to do it.
Right.
Otherwise, we're left with a fantasy scenario that 1,000 CEOs woke up one morning in a come-to-Jesus moment and said, I'm going to risk my business, and I'm going to act the way I've never acted in my entire business life.
Right. Yeah, it makes no sense. It makes no sense. I haven't bought into the theory that this was set up to fail. But, you know, in other words, a bunch of people sat around and said, okay, let's blow this thing up and take all the money and run and then let it crash. But I will go so far as to say that a bunch of people sat around and said, let's set this thing up. It's going to blow up. It's going to make a lot of money. It's going to do very well for us and our friends. It may have a bad consequence, but we'll be out of the way by the time it falls apart. And they probably weren't expecting it to fall apart as badly as it has. Maybe I'm giving too much credit to these guys.
Have you heard the theory of too much money?
I don't know.
Well, it was like on All Things or NPR that there's too much like volume of money floating around the world about 10 years ago.
Right.
And they needed to park it places, and that's kind of what ignited this.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, you know, it depends on how you define money. It's part of the problem. You know, one of the things that with dollars, I mean, we've been pumping dollars out like crazy. We stopped publishing M3 in 2003. Which was the measure of the inflation of our money supply. And so there are people who are suggesting that we've been inflating our money supply 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 15% a year over the last 5 years of the Bush administration. And that's going to come back to haunt us as inflation in the next 5 years. And I believe that it's true. But the worldwide money supply, on the other hand, you've got a bunch of other countries that are getting very wealthy. So they have to be increasing their money supplies. India and China in particular, and the oil countries. And they have to park their money someplace, but, you know, which is here, and they're buying our companies to do it. But I would say that our trade policies have set that up because we have to borrow from them to buy from them. And then, you know, they take that money and they take the money that we give them when we buy things from them and they buy us. I mean, it's kind of a cyclical mess, but, you know, point well made, Dave. Thank you very much for the call. Rick in San Luis Obispo.
Hi. I wonder why nobody seems to be talking about the fact that the Federal Reserve hasn't done everything it can to restore liquidity. They haven't lowered the interest rates back down to where Greenspan had to get liquidity after he raised them.
That's a good point.
And it seems that, you know, he was holding it at 2%, claiming that it was necessary to head off inflation. But, you know, here we have this huge crisis, and how can you use such an argument, you know?
As I recall, it didn't work for the Fed during the Great Depression. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a long time since I've looked at the numbers, but I think that the Fed, you know, the interbank lending rate, the lowest rate that they offer, was below 1% during much of the Great Depression, and interest rates were very low, and that did not ensure liquidity.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is that Greenspan kind of like created this template when he raised interest rates, then had to lower them all the way down to 1% in order to restore liquidity. So when Bernanke...
I don't think he was doing that to restore liquidity. I think he was doing that to reflate a bubble. You know, and Robbie Botcher lays this out in his book, Greenspan's Fraud. Greenspan was basically creating bubble economies. He was pumping and dumping them. And when one would collapse, he'd have to start another one. He always wanted to raise interest rates because that would make the economy, that would slow the economy down to the point where wages would go down. He was hysterical about wage inflation, not CEO wage inflation, but worker wage inflation. And, you know, famously in 89, I think it was, or 79, no, 89, said that he saw part of his principal job as being to maintain a certain minimum level of worker insecurity.
Well,
but then on the other hand, when he wanted to pump the economy because a Republican was running for president, you know, he'd drop interest rates in a heartbeat.
Well, I agree. But, you know, when he raised them to the point where the economy started to falter and then started lowering them, you know, a little bit at a time, there were economic repercussions all over the world. And he had to keep going down all the way to 1% before they would stop.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, but that was kind of his undoing the damage that he had done. I mean, it's an interesting question. Why, at least I'd love to hear Bernanke answer that. And I have to go back over the transcripts of his testimony yesterday. Whether anybody in Congress asked him, you know, why don't you just drop interest rates another 0.75 point and see what happens? 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. By the way, if you send email to our producers, or very often to me, I don't always get them. But we do, Louise and I both do read the On the Program blog every day over at TomHartman.com. So if you want to tell me if I'm right or wrong about something or whatever, that's generally the best way to reach me. And Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the web, a great news summary and service. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. The president today is going to make a 9.01 p.m. Eastern address to the nation on the financial issue here, and that will be top of the hit parade today. White House is going to try and get some speech points out to the press around 5 p.m. Eastern, so we'll have some idea of where he's going to go with that. As you know, today Bernanke testified before the Joint Economic Committee, and he said that if the bailout is not enacted, if credit woes will persist, and we will be in dire economic consequences. Meanwhile, the Republican Study Committee, it's a bunch of House conservatives, and they came up with their own alternatives. And they came up with almost a dozen or so different kinds of things that they had. And frankly, they don't look all that different in some respects than some of the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think pretty much everybody looks at this thing in horror at what the Bushies have come up with. And, I am concerned that if the Democrats dance, you know, go down this road, as Bernie Sanders said, this could be real destructive to their chances in the fall. My preferred suggestion is that we do what England does. In the United Kingdom, they do what we did from 1914 to 1966. We also did to finance the Spanish-American War and the Civil War, and that is that there is a 0.25% tax on the sale or purchase of any stock. So if we had the same tax that they have in the United Kingdom on stock, where they, by the way, don't have the problem of speculation like we have here, if we had that same tax here, it would generate $160 billion a year, which would more than pay for the bailout over a couple of years. Plus, it would cause people to, when they're making investment decisions, not say, hey, I think I'll buy, you know,
it would stop the churning.
That's right. I think I'll buy a million shares of stock in a particular company, hoping that that drives up the value of the company so that I can sell those shares tomorrow at a profit. I mean, that's what's going on, is the churn. And it's one of the things that's so destructive. And it's one of the reasons why we had it. It's one of the reasons why in 1936, John Maynard Keynes, in his book on economics, proposed, you know, or actually it was already in place at that time, but proposed that it wasn't just a good revenue source for the government. It would prevent speculation and encourage investment. And so that's my pitch. I wish some, and Peter DeFazio is out there pushing this really hard, the congressman from Oregon, and doing a great job of it. And I wish more people, members of Congress, would consider
the possibility. Well, you know, some of the Republican study committee, again, very conservative group of people, want the Fed to publish lists of financial firms that pose legitimate risks. They want them to replace immediately all senior management of these companies, freeze executive bonuses. I mean, these are conservatives that are sounding like some Democrats.
Yeah. And they're going to end up taking credit for it, and McCain is going to take credit. Well, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out.
I don't know that he's going to. I mean, right now he's not doing too well because of all of this.
Right. See, I think that the thing that was really revealing was yesterday when the Deputy White House Press Secretary said that this has been this proposal has been on the desk of the president, or has been in the White House for months. And so, okay, they were planning on this thing. I think that they were planning on this bomb falling, though, on November 5th. And in fact, my guess is that they already had the press releases written, and Bob Novak already had the article written. You know, so when the market falls like crazy the day after the elections, then they could say, see, it's because a Democrat was elected.
Yeah, I think you're giving them a little more credit than I think I would, these characters. But we'll see. Also, the McCain campaign had a conference call today and talking about where they're going, and they said the presidential debates is a black hole as for now, but something's gonna happen. He also said, this is, one of his major pollsters, and he said that the election is going to be decided in 12 swing states, Colorado, Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Nevada, followed by New Hampshire, North Carolina, Ohio, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
Yeah, amazing. You know, the right-wing talking points on this are this was all the Democrats' fault. This was actually a program that had a brand and a logo associated with it. It was called the Ownership Society. Here's George W. Bush talking about this, Ellen.
One of the larger obstacles to minority home ownership is financing. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have committed to provide more money for lenders. They've committed to help meet the shortage of capital available for minority home buyers. Freddie Mac recently began 25 initiatives around the country to dismantle barriers and create greater opportunities for home ownership. One of the programs is designed to help deserving families who have bad credit histories to qualify for home ownership loans. You don't have to have a lousy home for first-time home buyers. You put your mind to it, the first-time home buyer, the low-income home buyer, can have just as nice a house as anybody else.
Right. Yeah, that was October 2002.
That's a great one. That should be in the annals of Bush.
Why are we not hearing that anywhere on CBS, NBC, ABC News?
We need the Tom Hartman show.
There you go. Eleanor Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past. Well, it's the end of the show, actually. Tomorrow, Gloria LaRiva. She's running for president on the Socialism and Liberation Party's platform or ballot. She's going to tell us why socialism would be a great thing for America. Plus, Christy Harvey, Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, will be here with News Under the Radar. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.